Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
And welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet. I'm Reuben Stern. A lot of people around Mid-Missouri are participating in this year's One Read program by reading The Tiger's Wife. You may be one of them. Much of the praise around the novel stems from the skill of the author as a storyteller, but also interesting is the central role that the stories play in the narrative itself. The central character of the novel is a young physician named Natalia. Early on, she tells the readers, and I quote from the book here, "Everything necessary to understand my grandfather lies between two stories, the story of the tiger's wife and the story of the deathless man." She then goes on to recount the details of both of those two stories, intertwined with the larger story that she pieces together around her grandfather's death. The One Read program's collective reading of a story about stories provides a good opportunity for us to consider the role of stories in all our lives. Why are stories so important to us as humans? What effect do stories have on us, for better or for worse? And how might technology change the future of stories in our world? Joining me in the studio to talk about storytelling today, Berkeley Hudson is an associate professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Missouri. Previously, he was the director of the Storytelling Project at the Kotzen Children's Library of Los Angeles. Welcome to the program, Berkeley Hudson.
Thank you.
Glad to have you with us today. Also with us, Michael Porter is an associate professor and the chair of the Communication Department at MU. Welcome, Michael Porter.
Thank you.
Glad to have you with us. And joining us by phone, Jonathan Gottschall teaches English at Washington and Jefferson College in Pennsylvania and is the author of the book, The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human. Welcome to the program, Jonathan Gottschall. And we hope to hear from you and our audience as well. Is there a particular story that helped shape your life? If so, we'd love to hear about it. Give us a call at 573-882-8925, or you can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And let's start with this question. Jonathan, in your book, you write that, quote, "story is for a human as water is for a fish." What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, a different metaphor, I can't remember if I explore this in the book or not, but is gravity. You know, if you think about the gravity is this powerful and omnipresent force that we're moving through all the time, that's influencing us, that's shaping us, that's working on us all the time. And story is the same way. It's something for a human, story is this force like gravity that pervades and surrounds us and has power. But we're so used to it that we're hardly ever aware of it. Stories are not just about fiction and novels and TV shows and films. It's about dreams and daydreams and conspiracy stories and religious scripture and so on and so forth. You can go on, children's make-believe. So when you tot up all of these hours that humans spend in story world, we end up spending more time in the lands of make-believe than we do in the real world. And that's why I call us the storytelling animal.
Right. I want to give our panelists at the table here a chance to share their thoughts on that response. As Berkeley, you go ahead.
Ask the question.
What do you think about that? I mean, that idea that we swim in story like a fish swims in water. Is that from your vantage point, is that the way you see it?
That's the way I experience it because that's the way I grew up in Mississippi. My father ran the Main Street service station, Don't Cuss, Call Russ. So there were all kind of stories that circulated throughout the service station. And I lived in a place where the oral tradition was really strong because almost half the population was African American, and so the oral tradition and the African American tradition is incredibly strong, and that also influenced the white people there as well. So there's a lot of the boundaries aren't very clear, and so it was a whole mix of stories from all kinds of cultures, from the Scotch-Irish tradition as well as the African and Caribbean tradition where
right.
I grew up.
Michael Porter, your thoughts on that as a communication professor, is that how we live?
I think stories are absolutely central to who we are. I'm glad that we're starting to have these discussions and talking about things like narrative as if they are part of our everyday life, because they are. We just haven't called them that. And I think this is very important. I like to use stories when I teach in my classes, and I think most good teachers are good storytellers. Whether we know it or not, we are telling stories, and I think most teachers do it naturally.
Now, Jonathan, in your book, you point to a lot of scientific support for what Michael just said, right? That idea that, you know, if we're trying to teach somebody something, a story can help.
Yeah, I think this is really a sort of key insight. And as he was saying, quite correctly, I think, a lot of people have known this by instinct. So great teachers have known it by instinct. The world's priests and shamans and marketers have always known that if you really want to get an idea to burrow into a human mind, to get people to remember it, you need to work it into a story. So yeah, I think there's a lot of evidence for that, and it's coming out of labs. I mean, Tolstoy said a long time ago in a book called What is Art? He says, art is an infection, and it's about transmitting an idea to an audience, transmitting emotion to an audience. And stories are really good at doing that. Stories are infectious. There's a lot of research now coming out of psychology labs showing that story is better at getting people to change their minds about things than basically like kind of dry fact-based arguments.
That's interesting that you bring up that idea of a story as an infection, because one of the things you talk about in your book as well is the idea that, you know, there's a reason that we have stories in our evolution. So it seems that the idea that an infection that makes us better as humans, it seems like a contradiction there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it depends what kind of infection it is. The infection can be positive or negative. So there's, you know, it would be naive to say just that story is good. It's always wholesome and always wonderful and always nice. It's not. What you can say about story is that it's always powerful. So there's great examples from history, like, you know, Uncle Tom's Cabin, where Lincoln gets Harriet Beecher Stowe in the White House and says to her, "So you're the little woman who wrote the book that made this great war." Mm. And so Uncle Tom's Cabin, you know, helped shift attitudes towards slavery in America and, you know, move the country in a more positive direction. But there's plenty of examples from history also of where storytelling has been used in ways that, you know, most people would think were negative. So about 50 years after Uncle Tom's Cabin is published, a novel comes out called The Klansman, which is the basis for the film The Birth of a Nation, which sort of inflamed racial attitudes in a very negative direction.
Okay, I want to remind everyone quickly, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about storytelling and how it affects us as humans. Joining me in the studio are Berkeley Hudson, Associate Professor of Journalism at the University of Missouri, Michael Porter, Chair of the Department of Communication at MU, and on the phone, Jonathan Gottschall, author of the book The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human. For those of you in our audience, how have stories shaped your own life? We'd love to hear your story, so give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. Feel free to call in with questions for our panelists as well. And we'd like to remind you that Intersection takes place live every Monday at 2 on KBIA and online at kbia.org. You can be part of the conversation at that time and watch our video stream by going to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. Berkeley, I want to get your response to that idea of stories shaping our world.
Well, I was just going to follow up on the idea stories is powerful, but also the negative dark side of them. We interviewed a storyteller, my wife and I, Milbury Birch, who's a storyteller, as part of this project we did when we were going around the country interviewing storytellers, about 90 of them. And one in Hawaii told about how her grandmother wouldn't tell her stories about the human sacrifices. Even though those stories were very powerful within her tradition, the grandmother says, "Well, we don't do that anymore, and so we're not going to tell those stories to anyone anymore, and I'm not going to tell them to you." Mm. And so, you know, this was Nyla Fujibayab, I think, I can't remember her last name, but she talked about how, well, it's kind of painful to lose the story, but she understood why the story doesn't need to live now. And then that, I guess, kind of connects with the Joseph Campbell idea of, you know, myth and how it kind of goes under, mm-hmm. and then it comes back up and it goes under, depending on how the culture is living its lives. But so that's the dark side. And then also within the headhunter culture, too, in the Philippines, I remember in graduate school reading these amazing stories about headhunting culture and how the stories are passed on that tell you how to do it. and why it's done, the meaning of it in the culture, and the importance and significance of it. So,
interesting, interesting. Before we go forward, I want to take a call from one of our audience members, Barbie from Columbia. Are you with us?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks for joining the program today and for calling in.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the topic. The book that really influenced my life so much was My Side of the Mountain by Jean Craighead George. And that book, for a young girl growing up in the suburbs, it just transformed my life into realizing, because I was just felt like I'm stuck. And that brought me out to nature and to go to thinking what I could do. I could live in a tree and have a hawk and live in the tree all year round. It really transformed me and made me explore new ideas of how I can interact with nature, even living in the suburbs.
And did your life actually change as a result of the story in some way, besides that sense of possibility?
Yeah, I got really into recycling and looking at what a necessity it is for me to get out in nature and be out in it all the time, find a way to get there. So I'd get on my bike and I'd ride, you know, as a young girl, and I'd find a way to ride into whatever natural kind of environment I could find. And I was doing some of that already, but I could really explore that. And then I went into being a camp counselor and doing much more with nature. And now, like, I'm on the board of PetNet in Columbia right now. But it just made me realize how just integral that needs to be in my life, that nature needs to be.
Well, that's a good story. Thanks for sharing your story with us, Barbie. And thanks for joining our program today.
Those stories can be just life-saving. That's what it felt like for me. I felt trapped. And that story just opened the world out for me that you can do this.
Right.
Yeah.
Terrific. Well, thanks again for joining our program today. For others in our audience, if you have a story to share, feel free to give us a call. Our number is 573-882-8925. Responses from our panelists.
Well,
Michael, go ahead.
I think that's kind of indicative of the fact that of how important storytelling is, and for us to tell our own stories and to share those stories with others. And it's like, I had no idea, you know, what your life was like. And for you to tell me your story, share a little bit about who you are, you know, really makes you much more three-dimensional, right? And I think we all have interesting stories to tell about ourselves. And we are informed by the stories that we hear, which is, I think, what the caller was talking about.
Now, Jonathan, in your book, you talk about this as well, right? The role that stories play in us as a society.
Yeah, I mean, Barbie's comment was great, I think. And it plays into, I mean, you have this, I ask my students, why do people like fiction? Well, why do we do this? It's a strange thing for a species to do. We spend all this time immersed in the fake struggles of fake people. And they don't say we do it because it's fun. They know that's a shallow response. What they typically say is we do it to escape. Life is hard. Wonderland is easy. We go to stories to get some sort of vacation from the difficulties of life. So it's just escapism. It's a frill. But Barbie's response kind of gives a lie to that. We all have stories like this, about stories that have shaped us, stories that have changed us, that fly in the face of the sort of escapism model. And if you look at a lot of the psychology that's coming out nowadays, you find something interesting. A lot of times the response is personal and idiosyncratic, like Barbie's response was. But sometimes stories affect us all in very similar ways. So just to give an example of this, you have, over the last 15 or 20 years, massive changes in American attitudes towards homosexuality, massive, strong, fast liberalization of American attitudes. And the dominant social science explanation of this isn't the work of activists, isn't political action. It's been called the Will and Grace effect. It's the portrayal of positive, likable gay characters on television shows like Will and Grace and Glee and so forth that have changed American hearts and minds.
Interesting. Now, Jonathan, you also have a story of being moved by a story. It's what caused you to write the book, right?
Oh, yeah. I had this, you know, Yeah, I was driving down the road one day, and it's kind of beautiful fall day, and I was listening to music and kind of singing along, having a good time, and this country music song comes on the radio. And my usual response to that sort of catastrophe is to, like, just turn off the radio as quick as I can. But for some reason, you know, it was a nice day, and so I decided to listen, and it's a song about a father about a young man who's going to ask his sweetheart's father for her hand in marriage. And he goes to the man's house, and he waits in the living room, and he looks at the wall, and there's pictures of the little girl, or of his sweetheart as a little girl, and she's, you know, eating a popsicle and jumping on the bed, and she's dressed up as Cinderella. And it suddenly hits the young man that he is stealing something precious from the father. He's there to steal Cinderella. And so I'm having a good time and enjoying myself on the road, and the next thing I know, after hearing this song, I'm dissolving in tears and kind of pulling off the road to just bawl. It was weird. So part of me is having this kind of intense emotional experience, and part of me is having this sort of out-of-body experience, looking at myself and saying, whoa, what is going on here? I'm not really a weeper, and I've been sort of melted into helplessness by this sort of song that I don't even like. So the book was written, at least in part, to try to understand what happened to me that day. How is it that stories can have this sort of power over us?
And is there a scientific explanation for that, for what happened to you on that day that provoked that kind of response?
Well, one of them is yes and no. I think the yes part of the answer, I'll focus on that. The yes part of the answer is basically it appears like if you watch a film, and you watch the film inside an fMRI machine so that they can gauge your brain's reaction to the film. Your brain does not look like it's a passive observer of what's going on screen. It looks like it's a participant. So if you're watching a Clint Eastwood film and Clint is furious, you know, your brain's lighting up like it's angry. When you watch a sad scene, your brain looks sad. Not like it's an outside observer, but like, you know, it's lighting up as though it were actually sad. So the brain seems to have some trouble distinguishing between fantasy and real life. So when you get absorbed in a fiction story like I was that day on the road, I'm reacting as though that thing were actually happening to me.
Fascinating. Berkeley, please.
So I guess this connected storyteller and storytelling scholar Heather Forrest, in a dissertation she wrote about 20 years ago, talked about this idea that in brain studies had showed that the metaphorical experience that we have is housed next to the lived experience. And it doesn't make a distinction. And I think Jonathan, I believe, talks about that in his book, that idea that it's just, we don't know. We don't distinguish the two. But part of the good thing of that is we learn. The metaphors teach us. My wife, you know, says folk tales are the metaphoric retelling of somebody's either very good or very bad day. And our hearing those folk tales and hearing those stories, or watching the television or listening to the country music, we learn from that. Mm-hmm. You know,
right.
Some of us learn better and more easily than others.
Absolutely.
But.
Yeah, this is not, you talked about, you know, fiction being escape. And while there is that escape element and someone's life is more exciting than mine, but I think we have a lot to learn from these fictional characters.
Jonathan, you do cover this, right?
Yeah, I did too. Yeah, I'm actually arguing against the escape model. Yeah.
Good. Okay.
It is an escape. we do experience it as a pleasurable escape from our own lives. But if it's an escape, it's a really weird sort of escape. One of the things that impressed me the most in my research was this discovery. It's not a discovery in the sense that other people haven't thought of it before. It was just kind of amazing to me that fiction, no matter where you go, no matter when you go there, it's always about problems. It's always about trouble. It's never about people having a nice day. It's about, you know, these big problems that people face in their lives. So one of the ideas I explore in the book is that maybe the structure of fiction is a key to its function. So maybe the reason stories are problem-based is to allow us to have a sort of vicarious virtual reality experience in fiction, where we get to go through these problems alongside the protagonists, and we actually improve at achieving certain skills, or certain, you know, we're better prepared to deal with these problems in real life. And there's at least some experimental evidence for this. So psychologists have gone out and they've looked into this again, and they found that people who read a lot of fiction, as opposed to heavy nonfiction readers, tend to perform better on tasks of social skills and tests of empathic ability.
Interesting. Really quickly, I want to remind our audience here, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today, we're talking about the place of storytelling in the modern world, and joining me in the studio are Berkeley Hudson, Associate Professor of Journalism at the University of Missouri, Michael Porter, Chair of the Department of Communication at MU, and on the phone, Jonathan Gottschall, author of the book The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human. For those of you in our audience, what kind of role do stories play in your life? Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. Michael, you were going to jump in, and then we'll go to Berkeley
Jonathan,
as well.
Jonathan, can I ask you, I mean, if a story doesn't have conflict, what does it have? I mean, that seems to be innate to what story is all about.
Yeah. Now, again, I mean, on one hand, that's such a cliche. It's the first thing you would learn on Creative Writing 101. So I knew it, in one hand, but I was still surprised to find it so pervasively across cultures, across centuries, as far back as you can trace in literature and folklore, and to find it also the same problem structure in pretend play of little children, in dreams. Dreams are overwhelmingly about trouble and problems. Dreams are not dreamy. Thank goodness our dreams don't come true. Our dreams are typically pretty awful. So, if you take away problems from a story, you just don't really have something that people recognize as a story anymore. Or maybe they'll recognize it as a story, but not as a story that they would want to suffer through.
Right. Berkeley Hudson, your thoughts.
So I had a question for Jonathan and for all of us, and how this connects, how the storytelling process, and doesn't matter what platform or medium, but how that connects with listening and the quality of listening, and how that connects with what Jonathan was talking about, the quality of empathy.
Talk more about that. By listening as part of that equation?
What I notice is people who are good storytellers are also good story listeners. They're talkers. They're all day talkers, some of them, but they're also listening, and so they're just taking in all their experience and all around them, and then it just comes through them, and it comes through their story machine into their story machine, and then it comes out again as story.
Jonathan, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I didn't get into this specifically, I'll just tell you one idea that occurred to me as you were saying this, I assume you're talking mainly about oral storytellers, aren't you?
Right, but I'm also now thinking other kinds of storytellers too.
Yeah, it made me think of fiction writers, and fiction writers are also very similar. You know, they're all-day talkers, they're all-day writers.
Right.
That's their goal. But they realize that in order to tell the best stories, they also have to be listeners. They have to be massive consumers of other people's beautiful words. Mm-hmm. So the advice you get from fiction writers tends to come down to two things. You boil it down to two things. One is, in order to be a good writer, you have to write a lot. You should actually be out there practicing it. And the second piece of advice they tend to give is, read a lot. Listen all the time. Be constantly bringing in raw material that you can use in your own work.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that struck me in your book, Jonathan, was the discussion of the kinds of stories that we choose to read and what that says about us as well, that that idea of literature shaping us, but also what we go to stories to get out of them and what kinds of stories we go to when we make choices about story.
Yeah, I think people are too impressed by the surface variability of stories. So on one hand, story seems massively diverse and massively wildly creative. But on the other hand, if you look at it from a different point of view, the point of view I look at it from in the book, you find stories are massively similar. There's a basic sort of skeleton, a basic sort of structure that storytellers almost never violate. We've already talked about one aspect of this. It'd be problem structure. I call it in the book problem structure, and I call that the universal grammar of stories. It's so strongly represented. So stories are about trouble. But it's not meaningless trouble. It's almost never meaningless or pointless trouble. There's almost always a point. There's a message. There's some sort of value structure that's being conveyed. So stories are almost always, whether implicitly or explicitly, making some sort of judgment on what is right and what is wrong.
Berkeley, would you agree with that? As
yeah.
a central tenet of storytelling, that moral sort of framework has to be there in order for story to work?
Yeah, they're cautionary tales, they're instructive tales. They, you know, like if you look at religious stories, they all have a reason why they're being told. And there's a reason why we hear stories that are, you know, 1,000 years old, 2,000 years old, 3,000 years old, 5,000 years old, 10,000 years, however old it is. You know, the stories that last, the classics, last because of that, I think.
It's fascinating. Jonathan, thoughts on that? Stories that last and why that may be the case?
Yeah, I think he's onto it. But again, it's not something I got into specifically for the book about like what makes a classic. One thing I would like to say is people are quick to grant this point when it comes to folk tales or religious tales and so forth. They say, oh yeah, that's clearly about getting a lesson across, getting a message across. The more controversial idea would be to say, well, that's also what modern fiction's about. That's what modern stories are about. That they also have a sort of value structure. And the more common idea is that stories are tearing down the moral fabric of society. You know, because stories are about trouble, and so they tend to be about vice and depravity and murder and all that stuff. But what's important to note is in almost always, although stories focus on bad behavior, they almost always condemn the bad behavior. There's always this sort of author's disapproval. So one of the ideas I explore in the book is that possibly part of the function of story, again, thinking about it from a big picture point of view, why do we tell stories, is to sort of draw us together around the same sort of common morality. So the idea would be that stories make societies work better by drawing us together around common values and providing a sort of social glue.
Right. Michael Porter, you're nodding
to
that.
Well, right. I'm just thinking, I like to think of television programs as being the community fire pit that people sit around so that people are telling the stories of their community, and they are all morality plays. They're all telling us a lesson so that we can be better members of that community. That's the ultimate purpose of many of these stories, especially in the oral tradition, don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm very glad you said that. I use a very similar metaphor in the book.
Yeah.
That, you know, the movie screen, the sort of flicker of the movie screen is, you know, the same as the fire pit. We're all gathered around that fire pit to listen to the master storyteller weave the story orally, or we're sitting around in a movie theater having the same experience of being tuned up together, synced up together.
We're going to, unfortunately, Jonathan, we're going to have to stop there to take a break. I want to thank you for joining us really fast.
We're
going to have to cut off for just a second here. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about storytelling, and I hope that you'll stick around with us after the break. We'll be right back. And welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the art of storytelling and its place in our world. Joining me in the studio are Berkeley Hudson, Associate Professor of Journalism at the University of Missouri, and Michael Porter, Chair of the Department of Communication at MU. In the first half, we had Jonathan Gottschall, an author, with us. He had to say goodbye, but we hope that you will stick around and continue to be part of our conversation. And I have a question for you. What is your favorite story? We'd like to know. We're talking about story today. So give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. Before the break, we were talking about the influence of story and the collective viewing experience of stories. And I want to talk a little more about that. One of the things that Jonathan talks about in his book is the shift from communal storytelling into this technology where we can sit on our couch by ourselves and watch a story, and whether or not that still counts as a collective experience. And I'm interested in kind of putting that on the table, and let's talk about that a little bit, collective versus individual experience with story.
You know, I think it remains a collective experience. The point is, you are not, it's not a collective experience with people who are with you geographically or in the same space or time. But you are now a member of a different community of people interested in different issues, and you can hear these stories on the internet, and your group of friends now, the other people listening to this story or telling the story, can be around the world. They can be in other parts of the country. They can be of different ages, of different genders. It doesn't matter. As long as the internet has a possibility to bring people together, and a lot of them share their stories.
So it's like the water cooler discussion. You know, Facebook is like the water cooler where people gather after they watched. And, you know, some years ago, I used to watch L.A. Law or, you know, Hill Street Blues. Or mm-hmm. you'd hear mm-hmm. our Twin Peaks, like when Twin Peaks with David Lynch was on.
Yes.
And everybody would be talking about it the next day. So now it's not the next day. It's right when it's happening.
Yeah.
It is a different experience. But, you know, they talked about how once VHS came in, that there wouldn't be any more movie theaters.
Yeah.
But we like to get together, however we are going to get together, and people are still going to movies, you know. So
of course, they said that about movie theaters when television came out.
Right.
They said television is going to be the death of the movie theater. So what did the movie theaters do? They designed big blockbuster movies, you know, Ben-Hur, The Ten Commandments.
And they brought in Cappuccino.
Yeah, okay.
And now we have 3D movies.
And now we have 3D movies. That's right.
Interesting. I want to just quickly mention a comment from one of our guests in our chat room here. The comment is this: my experience with Ericksonian psychology in seminary had a profound impact on my life. The idea that a story could create just a 1% change in my perception and action and ultimately create a huge change in my life was so powerful. So again, a comment from one of our audience members in the chat room.
That's a very good point. And, you know, I think that we don't appreciate or think about the impact of stories on our lives enough. And I think that that's a very good observation. And I wish more people thought about that. And, you know, we are just reading these novels, even if they're escapist fare, just to kind of get away and to kill time. I think that they do bring us into the moral structure of our society.
Right. Just speaking about teaching, this summer I was teaching Mizzou Journalism Study Abroad in London, and I had my wife, storyteller Milbury Birch, come in. But first I asked the students to collect murder stories from the London British newspapers, and I didn't tell them why. And then I said, now bring them in next time. So bring in a stack of them. So they brought in stacks of these murder stories. And then Milbury and I divided them up, and we gave them murder ballads, you know, Scottish and English, you know, Scotch-Irish murder ballads, you know, and had them reenact these murder ballads, and they tore up the pieces of newspaper to make costumes out of these. And so it was kind of an amazing for them to see, well, here's the connection to this story they're reading about the billionaire, you know, who... you know, stayed with his wife even after she was dead for months, or, you know, other murders that were going on. He didn't murder her, but that, you know, it was just making that connection and seeing. So these are morality plays, these cautionary tales that are explaining, you know, how come, why did this happen, how did it happen, what happened, and what does it mean? So I think we're captivated by that in our bones, you know, from cave days. You know, from cave days to digital days.
Interesting. We have a caller on the line. Michael, are you with us?
Yes.
Okay, Michael, thanks for joining the program and for calling in today.
Well, I'd like to just add a plug for the fictional story as opposed to the non-fictional. I feel like one can, no matter how fantastic the fictional story is, one can kind of assess its validity to yourself. And we get so many non-fictional stories that, particularly we're going to be getting them in a political season, supposedly, you know, non-fictional stories that, I think we're held. I somehow trust non-fiction less than fiction.
Interesting.
That's my comment.
Interesting. Well, thanks. Thanks for calling in. I'm going to give our panelists a chance to respond to that. Berkeley, the fiction of nonfiction and vice versa.
Well, I'm thinking about it. And I'm thinking about the ideas that Jonathan, you know, talked about, how fiction was more powerful. But I mean, I think what matters is a story true. And that's what he's saying, is that doesn't seem to be as much truth in a story that's being presented as truthful, nonfiction.
What do you think of that, Michael?
Yeah,
our ability to, as we attempt to function here, and we're relying on on that truth in order to
I think that the fictional narrative is oftentimes more interesting because it is fictional. You know, I hate to say this. We're basically pretty boring people. You know, the story of my life is not going to turn anyone's eye towards me and say, wow, what an interesting guy. It's my life, and it's a personal life, but it's not going to sell novels. And so in order for someone to write a novel that is going to sell, this person has to be bigger than you or me.
Yeah, I mean, Michael, thanks again for calling in with this, because I think it's an interesting point. I mean, one of the things that we've been hearing just this week, the Republican National Convention is going to be taking place this week, and we've been hearing a lot about the story that they're going to craft around a political candidate, and both sides do this. I mean, it's
sure.
part of the political
sure.
process. It's almost as if they're figuring out that story is more powerful than truth. Yes? No?
Well, it's story. Everything is story. And so all of our candidates have to have a story. And we have to make these people a little larger than life.
Berkeley, what do you think of that as a journalist?
Well, again, I think the problem in journalism is that the business of journalism doesn't want to take the time, the effort, the energy, and spend the money to get at those real big stories that actually exist. That takes a lot of work, a lot of time, a lot of energy, and a lot of courage to do. I don't know about Mike's life, but I mean, I think there's some really compelling, interesting stories in ordinary people as well as, you know.
Absolutely.
But that takes a lot of time and energy. So access is the key. Politicians don't want to give you access because of what's there and because they can't control the story if they let that access go. And they want to control the story.
You know, NPR has a whole series, and I don't know the name of this, where people go someplace and they kind of tell their story.
Postcards.
Is that what it is?
The postcards.
And it's like, and they are very compelling stories. And it's, you know, these are real things that happen to real people.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, it's like, it's their life. And the fact that it's real, I think makes it even more compelling than if I were to read it. Or watch it in a movie.
Right. Well, This American Life has captured that.
I think
that's
what
Ira Glass. I mean, they're taking the time.
Right.
Yes.
And there are a number of projects out there trying to get people to share their own stories, too, and to record those, like StoryCorps and things like that.
Right.
But, yeah, in a political discourse, it does get difficult to figure out what's the story and what's the truth, as Berkeley said, right? Interesting. I want to just throw in another comment from our chat room here. This is a comment from Paul in our chat room. The guests are half right, Paul says. Television is a pit, but what radiates from it is not the warmth of flame, but the warmth of manure, in my humble opinion. This is what one of our audience members, Paul, says. What do you think of that, Michael?
I don't agree with that. I think there's a lot we could say about television and the stories that television tells us, but it does tell us. Here's the problem that's going on with television today is, you know, in the old days before the internet, before computers, there were three campfires, NBC, CBS, and ABC, and okay, PBS, and everybody sat around one of those campfires, and we all heard the same stories. Now we have 5,500 campfires out there, and you can go to your own individual campfire, hear the stories that are intriguing to you, listen to that stories with other people, but then you don't hear the other stories, right? Because there's only so much time. And so we are all watching and interacting with television in a very unique way and in our own way.
In a way, it's sort of a metaphor for the world, right? We have indoor heat now. We don't need to sit around a campfire for warmth.
Right. That's right.
And one thing that we discovered in our storytelling project was if you went to a place with an outhouse and not much electricity, there were really good storytellers around there.
Interesting. And they probably sat on the front porch.
Or the back porch.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because there aren't that many places in the world left that have outhouses and no indoor heat, right? I mean, that's it. Mm-hmm. Our landscape is shifting quite a bit here in terms of those places where they might have had really good storytellers. What's that doing to story?
It's just changing it. You know, it still exists. I mean, that people are, I agree with him, Jonathan Gottschalk. I mean, we are storytelling animals. You know, yeah, and I don't care whether we're in a high rise in New York City or not. I mean, it's different. Yes. What I meant by the outhouse and electricity was I knew that I would find storytellers there. I don't always know I'm going to find a storyteller in a high rise, but the storytellers are there.
Mm-hmm. And so how is it different? If it's not, if it's not going away, what's changing about story as we move into a more technological future?
I think the interaction between the storyteller and the audience is changing. I think that there are many more people are going online, creating their own blog, and telling their story. That's basically all it is. Their story, their view of the world, and those who want to come and listen, great, come along. If you don't want to listen, don't go there. You know, it's totally up to you. But that audience is a different audience than the people that walk down Main Street by your front porch where you used to sit. Now the audience is anyone out there that wants to listen to your story.
What do you think, Berkeley?
I think that's true. I mean, I think it is, you know, I'm an optimist. So that's sort of, you know, so yes, is there manure on television? Yes, there's always
well,
been
manure.
Of course
there is.
There's
yeah.
always been manure on television.
Terrible stuff.
But, and yes, is there manure in blogs?
Of course. Yeah.
Yes. But so it's just a different platform. But there I told the story the other day that a lot of times storytellers tell, which is, it's the story of how in an African village, they had a griot, and everybody sat around the campfire and listened to the griot, the storyteller. And they loved the griot. But then somebody came in and says, oh, we've got a television. We want to show you this, because they wanted to sell television. Yeah. So they brought in the television, and they had a satellite. And there were people were, oh, well, this is more interesting than the griot. So they sat around, and they watched the TV, and they watched the TV. But after a while, they kind of got bored, because it wasn't telling their story.
Yeah, yes,
telling
that's
a different,
right.
different story.
Yes, yeah.
And so the guy with the television came back and said, well, how's it going? No, we want you to get rid of the TV. We want to just sit and listen to the griot. Yeah. He said, well, why? He says, because the griot knows us.
Yeah.
The television doesn't know us.
Oh, that's good. That's really good.
So.
I think you could take that same example and extend that to the blog. It's like this person who's writing the blog that I'm following knows me, knows my interests.
Right.
And it's like, okay, I want to hear your stories. And those who don't want to hear those stories don't have to listen to them.
But how does that person know you? I mean, how is that? What's different there?
Well, they don't know me unless I respond to their blog. And so then there's the possibility of feedback, and that feedback loop is very important for this to work. And I think it provides ammunition, if you will, for the storyteller to say, oh, yeah, that reminds me, I could tell you this story, because I know that Joe Blow out there in mid-Missouri is interested in this.
And but, so in some ways that connects with this idea of the storytelling trance that occurs in a live setting versus a digital setting, where the story is created between by the storyteller and the audience create the story anew every time the story is told, whether the story's one day old or 10,000 days old, 10,000 years old, and that's that the story is created out there among between them, and the story lives.
Yes,
it lives, and that's how it lives, and that's how it then it gets told again and again and again. And so the feedback, I was just thinking about how the feedback loop connects with that.
Absolutely.
And the storytelling trance.
And and it may alter the story a little bit. You know, a new adjective. A new,
right, but that's okay.
Point. Yeah, absolutely.
The bones of the story get bleached.
Yes.
Over time.
I like that. I like that.
And are you saying that's a purer form of story, or?
I'm just saying that's how story works.
Okay, this is The Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the tradition of storytelling, and joining me in the studio are Berkeley Hudson, an associate professor of journalism at the University of Missouri, and Michael Porter, chair of the Department of Communication at MU. For those of you in our audience, is there a way that story has shaped your life? We'd love to hear your own story. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. I want to ask you about something else that Jonathan Gottschall talks about in his book, which is the idea that technology is enabling a way for us to participate as the protagonist in stories in a way that we couldn't before. So, you know, in a classic story medium, we would consume a story, and we would watch it and we might learn from it and be socialized by it and all those things we've talked about. But something that's new is this idea to have an immersive experience where you become the protagonist who shapes the story around you. And specifically, he talks about online role-playing games and massive multiplayer games and things like that, where it's an immersive story creation experience beyond simply consuming someone else's tale. And I wonder, if you could talk a little bit about, I mean, is that an area that you think is potentially good for story, bad for story?
Well, I think one example of where it's good is at the MU campus. Kim Anderson is doing work with domestic violence, where people are learning to tell their stories and to record them digitally, for them to help to understand what has happened to them, and how they can learn from it and respond to it. I don't know if that quite connects.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, do you know more about how that works?
I mean, it's an ongoing project involving survivors of domestic abuse, and they do digital interviews, and then the person then starts to edit his or her own story, and work with it themselves as part of a therapeutic situation.
Fascinating.
I think the whole idea of it's almost. Do video games fall into what you're talking about?
I would think any. I mean, that's a question too. I mean, what constitutes a story these days, right?
Yeah, I'm not a video gamer, so I don't exactly know how that works. But that whole issue of one having an avatar, and that avatar becomes their
second life.
The whole second life thing. Yeah. It's interesting.
But things haven't taken off quite the way they said they were. In the 90s, there was this idea that you were going to be in the story and you would pick your own ending. Yeah. And that's it really never has quite taken off, though, the way they said it would. And with all the games, where you had all these different options. And I don't know. It hasn't quite happened.
No, it hasn't.
Right. Although, I mean, he does write about gamers who, spend 30 hours a week in an alternate universe where they are living a totally different set of challenges and problems and interactions.
But think about what that must do to that individual. I just can't imagine immersing myself.
They drop out of my classes.
You're right.
I had World of Warcraft people who, they're so addicted, they're gone.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it must totally change their sense of reality.
Interesting. But, it does bring about this idea that story is becoming much more than what we traditionally think of it, right? A lot of times when we talk about story, we think about the novel, or we think about, short stories or specific literary forms. And and I think one of the points is that story is becoming a much broader thing, right? Yeah. I mean, even the campus is attempting to prepare students for jobs in a story world that is well beyond those traditional forms, right? I mean, Michael, you know a little more about that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We're working on a new undergraduate degree program in digital storytelling, which we are still moving through all the different channels to get that approved. But this is designed to be very interdisciplinary, cross colleges even. It includes faculty and departments in the College of Arts and Science, School of Journalism, College of Education, Engineering, architectural studies, trying to provide a major for those students who maybe aren't content with what's here. And they're looking for something different. They maybe don't know what it is. But we get a lot of students who come here, and it's like, gee, this, what I want to do is I want to tell stories. And we don't have a major that's kind of just that. And so we thought, well, maybe we could work together and create a new undergraduate degree program that would build on the courses we have, create a few new courses, and help the student to get some skills, some background, some understanding of narrative structure, narrative theory, so that they could then use that and apply that for a new career.
Right. I mean, it just seems that there are all sorts of possibilities at large, right?
Absolutely. And I think based on what's happening out in the real world, I think that there is a demand for people with this skill set. I think we see this as very much a writing-based program, so that the students will come out as we hope, you know, very solid writers, but being able to help others tell their stories and tell stories about other people. That will probably be shown in maybe a smaller form, a digital format. Maybe these are going to be YouTube stories. Maybe these will be short little stories on a corporation's webpage. I mean, who knows? But there's a lot of demand for that.
And I would make the argument like you are that you've got to understand the bones of story.
Absolutely.
If you don't understand the bones of story, you can know how to work a camera or iMovie or whatever all day long. But
right.
if you don't get
right.
What is a story?
Right. So which
in
is like
the most basic sense.
And that's the whole foundation of the program is based on this narrative theory, a narrative structure, understanding that.
Right. Let me. I want to bring in another comment from our chat room here. Melissa in the chat room asked this question: how do you think the internet has changed storytelling in terms of anonymity and the level of sharing? And this gets a little bit back to a comment Berkeley made very early on regarding stories that do get told or don't get told, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I want to continue this thought from Melissa. I'm amazed and sometimes appalled at the kinds of things my students reveal about themselves in class. Is some of this the result of the anonymity on the internet? What do you think of that? That idea of, you know, the medium shaping the kinds of stories that we tell.
And maybe there's the Oprah effect as well.
Yeah. What do you mean by that?
Well, just a culture in which, you know, you just tell everything.
Yeah,
you know, and it's just there are no boundaries.
Yeah.
There are no.
That's right. So students don't seem to be embarrassed by what you and I may blush at and not really want to share. They're just willing to blurt it out. It's like it's not a big deal. It's on my Facebook page. You know, I mean, look at students' pictures that are on there.
Right, but then the question becomes: how do you tell that story so it can be heard? And knowing that there are all these different kinds of listeners. We are a human, we are a storytelling animal, but we are, you know, we are different. You know,
mm-hmm.
we're different sizes, shapes, colors,
right.
experiences.
Right.
And
right.
so, you know.
Well, maybe part of the issue here is that because of that, because we are all different, I may put my story out there, and it's out there. And so other people are hearing my story that I really don't want to hear my story. But because it's on the internet, maybe it's on Facebook, maybe it's on YouTube, it's open to everybody. And so some may say, oh my God, that's revolting. And others may say, this is fabulous, I love it. And it's like, well, it really is designed for those people to love it, not for those people who are revolted by my story. It's like, this is why I don't listen to certain music forms anymore. Because it doesn't speak to me.
Yeah. But it is interesting, in the One Read book, The Tiger's Wife, there's a point where the grandfather wakes the narrator up in the middle of the night when she's young and takes her out into the city because he saw that this elephant in the middle of the night when no one is watching, this elephant is being guided through the city back to the zoo by a soldier. And so he takes her and she witnesses this thing and he says, now, this is a story you keep. You don't give this story to other people. You have to be very careful what you do with the story. This is our story,
right.
Not everybody's story. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, when we went to the Navajo Reservation to visit Pansy Frank, who had never allowed herself to be recorded before, and she was 90 years old, and this was in about 1997, Milbury and I were there, and we went with her actor-storyteller granddaughter, Jerry Keems, who started out in movies with Clint Eastwood and The Outlaw Josie Wales. And they had to have a kill a sheep and have a council meeting before they decided to let Milbury and myself come there to record the stories.
We actually have a clip of this, so I'm going to play the clip and then let's talk a little more about it after that. So let's go ahead and play the clip of who?
Jerry Keems. Talking about her grandmother, Pansy Frank.
Mm. In the Navajo tradition, they say that stories are like energy. And in the Navajo way, our stories, the ones we grow up with, are ones that we hold close to us. And so in a way, my grandmother said, because these stories have energy, they're like protectors. And they shield us from the harshness and the hardness of the world. And if we tell too many of our stories and we give away knowledge and stories freely, she said, you are then breaking down your shield or your barrier that shields you from the chaos of the world.
Wow. Okay, a much different way of looking at things from most people on Facebook, right?
Right. Yeah. And it's also the complete opposite to Ray Hicks, who was a storyteller that we've visited with a number of times in Banner Elk, North Carolina, who was an all-day talker. You know, who gave it away freely like water to anybody who pulled their car, you know, could find him down the gravel road up the mountainside and would come in and say, "Hey, I hear you're a storyteller." And then they'd be there for like 8 hours later trying to figure out a way to get back in the car because they had heard enough jack tales.
Well, it's interesting in terms of the way that this might shift things. I mean, is technology going to make everybody, you know, a storyteller that makes you wonder how you're going to get back in the car after 8 hours? Or is story going to maintain some of its power?
I don't think so. I don't think everybody, although I think we're natural storytellers, I think some are better at it than others. And I think that a lot of people aren't going to want to share their stories.
Berkeley, what's your thought on that?
Yeah, I'm not concerned about it one way or the other. I mean, it will. I just see things in mythological terms, and you know, over time, it cycles back and forth. I mean, I'm a Joseph Campbell devotee that way. I mean, I think the stories that we need for the time emerge during that time, and they arise.
Okay, that's probably a good place for us to stop today. I'd like to thank our guests today. Joining me in the studio, Berkeley Hudson, Associate Professor of Journalism at the University of Missouri, and Michael Porter, Chair of the Department of Communication at MU. Thanks also to our phone guest, Jonathan Gottschall, author of the book, The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human. Thanks also to the people who called in today, and for those of you joining us in the chat room. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday. You can join us each Monday afternoon by listening to KBIA or by going online to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. There you'll be able to watch a video feed of the program, submit your questions and comments, and also participate in an online chat with others in the audience. You'll also find a video archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Today's program was produced by Raymond Tungekar. Travis McMillan is our technical director, with assistance from Danny Madison. Pat Akers is our audio producer. I'm Reuben Stern. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week. I'm Intersection host Reuben Stern, and related to our conversation today about storytelling, MU professor Berkeley Hudson is going to tell us a story.
This is no news. It comes partly by way of down east in Maine, where two storytellers up there, Robert Bryan and Marshall Dodge, used to tell this story. And then Connie Reagan Blake and Barbara Freeman, the folk tellers, they picked it up from them, and they're down in Appalachia, and so they've got their version of it, of No News, and it kind of goes like this, and I'm telling a shorter version of it probably, though I'm not quite sure yet how short it'll be, but it won't be that long. And I use this in my classes to help students understand the difference in inverted pyramid structure, and also to understand that sometimes when you're interviewing people, they have a lot of great information, but it takes a while to get it out of them. And sometimes there are ways you can learn from the structure of how they tell the story about how to tell your story then. So no news. There was once a certain southern gentleman who had been away for a while, and he came back home on the train, and his friend met him at the station. And so the gentleman says, "So tell me, what's the news?" The other fellow says, "Well, there is no news." "Oh, well, something must have happened while I was gone." Well, it's true. Your dog died. I just didn't want to tell you." "Oh, no, not my dog, my prize dog." "Yeah, he died because he ate the burnt horse flesh." "Burnt horse flesh? Where would he get any burnt horse flesh from?" "Oh, well, the horse burned up because the barn burned down." "The barn burned down?" "Yeah, yeah, and that caught on fire from the house, from the sparks from the house. Caught the barn on fire and burned the barn down, and then burned the horse, and then the dog ate the burnt horse flesh, and then the dog died. What do you mean, the house burned down? Yeah, that's from the sparks from the candle that was around the coffin. Who died? Oh, no. Well, that was your wife who died. Oh, no. She died? Yeah, well, she died, and that was the shock of oh, Lord have mercy. I might have forgotten the end of it here. Now, your wife died. Yeah, no. Your wife died? No, that was your mother who died. Your mother who died. Sorry about that. I got it mixed up there. No, your mother died. She died from the shock of the fact that your wife ran off with the stable boy. But other than that, there's no news. Anyway, that's no news. A truncated version.